ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, we're going to look at what Pinterest did to combat misinformation on its platform and what other companies are and aren't doing to do the same. Also, I don't know if you knew this, but it's Oscars week. So we're going to talk to a couple of people about how Hollywood is changing and why this year's Academy Awards have been such a crazy mess. But first, the second biggest phone launch of the year happened this week. Samsung launched five new phones with confusingly similar names, each with like 40,000 cameras and 8-foot screens. I don't know if I have those specs right, but we'll get back to that. And there were headphones and wearables and foldable phones and all kinds of stuff. So is this the dawn of a new era in phones? Here to actually know the specs and tell me more, Joanna Stern in New York and Christopher Mims, presumably back in his attic in Baltimore?
No, I'm only coming to you from mythical locations. So I am hanging with the Oracle at Delphi, getting high on the fumes.
It actually does sound like that.
Right?
You do sound a little...
I can tell you about the future, but I can only speak in Zen Koan. Sorry.
That's beautiful. Well, we can just sit here silently while you do that for a while. That could be fine. Joanna,
to sit here silently.
You have to tell us about phones.
You know, I was in a meeting earlier this week, and there was a long conversation about that there's no sound in space, but there is sound in space. There's just no sound. It's the sound of no sound. And I said, wow, we should just do a podcast with no sound.
Okay.
And then we should label it called There's No Sound in Space.
You should do a podcast that's just very quiet white noise.
Yeah. That's
just like rustling. Call it Office Sounds.
Or what it sounds like in space.
Okay.
I don't know what your offices sound like. Mine is like insanely loud, full of people yelling into phones all the time. That doesn't sound like a
And by the way, this wasn't a tangent. We're talking about the Galaxy phones. Get it?
This is just
Should
awful.
We start from the beginning?
No.
Yeah, let's start over. We've already derailed this entire podcast.
Rewind. Start again.
Joanna, you saw some of the Galaxy phones like a week ago, right? So you've had a week to think about this and you wrote a piece. Run us through the Samsung stuff. There's like a billion phones with 8 billion cameras, and that's about all I know.
Yeah, I mean, Samsung kind of took us by surprise this week, but also didn't at all. So people that are in the phone industry have been following this really closely. There's been lots of rumors about the Galaxy S10 for the last number of weeks and months, and we basically knew everything about these phones, right? And I can run down some of the exciting features, and I think they are exciting. The built-in fingerprint sensor to the screen worked really fast, tried it out. It's on the two higher-end models of the phones. They have multiple cameras on the phones now. The Galaxy S10 and the 10 Plus have three cameras. There's a 5G model that is not yet available, and the price is not yet available, but that's going to have four cameras on the back. So they've done a lot of cool things with these S10 phones, but they're like incremental updates. As I wrote in the piece, like, these are great phones to upgrade from your already great phone, but it doesn't like push the bar in the way that a lot of the early Samsung Galaxy S phones did. And you know, Samsung was one of the first to come out with bigger screens. They were one of the first to come out with the much higher end OLED screens and better cameras, etc. I was excited about them. I was like, okay, these, you know, maybe I wasn't as excited. I was just like, these are, you know, good Android phones. It's fine. And then Samsung has the event yesterday, and David, you were there, and maybe you want to take now over what happened. But you know, then they announced this like really crazy awesome phone, or at least something that looks crazy awesome for the future. And then I feel like nobody cared about these S10 phones.
Yes, it reminded me of, I guess it was a year and a half ago now, when Apple introduced the iPhone X and the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus. And their whole basic idea was the iPhone X is like this cool sort of futuristic science project that you're not going to buy yet, but here are these other cool phones that you might like. And everybody's like, screw that. Like, tell me about this exciting new thing that doesn't look like every phone you've been making for a decade. So Samsung had this event. And as soon as the thing started, there was this monstrous three-pane sort of folding stage that was just one huge screen. It was very cool. They just came out, and before anything happened, just like boom, introduced a foldable phone, which had been rumored for a long time, and lots of companies have been sort of saying they're working on it. And this was just Samsung being like, we did it. It was called the Galaxy Fold, which I don't think is a good name, but that's okay.
What are you talking about?
Why
the heck else
Why
would we call it? The Galaxy 10 RG58? At least it says what it does, right?
Man.
I guess that's true. Just call it the Galaxy. Just be like, screw all of this. This is I'm pro. I think the only iPhone name should just be iPhone, and it should be like
gotta,
car model year.
We got to remember, though, that the people who are buying Samsung devices in the U.S. are like walking into a Verizon and just saying to the clerk, like, hey, I need a phone anyway. And they're like, fold?
True.
They know their audience.
No, so are you guys into this foldable phone thing? I'm extremely pro foldable phones, and I
was ready
feel
like to hate it.
I'm the only one.
It. Joanna, what do you think?
I'm into it. That's what I'm saying. Like, I was like, yeah, these S10s, they're cool. And then like, then this big thing comes along. You're like, oh yeah, those S10s suck. These are awesome. This is awesome. And like, truth is, like, you know what? The foldable phone, like, I can't wait to play with it, and we'll review it at some point. And like, I think we, and I don't want to go into the review thinking this, but like, we kind of know it's not going to be great right now, right? Like any first generation product like that especially is not going to be the mass market thing. And Samsung's not pitching that either, right? It's like $2,000 at the, well, I mean, $2,000 without the 5G. It's only available to carriers. They haven't said the battery life, but I think it's like 2 minutes. You know, there's all this stuff that's going to hold back this from being this mainstream phone. But yet, like, it's what we should be excited about.
It reminds me, if I'm reaching way back, do you guys remember the 25th anniversary Macintosh? It cost like $10,000.
Yes.
I'm going to send you a picture. I'm just glad that they're producing luxury objects again that people can use to signal, hey, I paid $2,000 for this phone. I think Apple missed the boat on Veblen goods, and that is why they can't sell their high-priced phones anymore. If you want to sell high-priced phones, you better put, like, fins on it or something. Like, there needs to be a way for people to look at it and know, oh shit, that person paid $1,500 for that phone.
But one of the things that you also realize is they also released the S10 5G, which is going to be one of the first 5G phones, four cameras. One includes a depth sensor for advanced AR stuff, two cameras on the front. It's like loaded up with, is this the one that has up to a terabyte, or they all have up to a terabyte? Who knows? Anyway, you know that phone's going to start at $1,500.
Yep.
Or $1,200 or somewhere in that ballpark.
It's $1,600 for the 1 terabyte.
It's on the
S10 Plus.
Can we
talk for a minute about who? What do you do with a terabyte of storage on your phone?
Right, yeah, that's the $1,600 phone. That doesn't include the fact that you can go up to the 5G S10 and get, again, four cameras, 5G, bigger battery, everything that you ever wanted in a phone that doesn't fold. And that's probably also going to start around $1,400. Or $1,600. So like,
yeah,
you look
I
at all of these
true.
Options, and even then the foldable phone's like, that's actually pretty affordable because it folds, and that's only $2,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind
wow,
of love Samsung
I can't believe
for
you just called
this.
It affordable.
I know.
What world do you live in?
Downright cheap.
Seriously, what is the use case? Just imagine a world where it's 5 years from now and all phones fold. How are we going to use these things?
It's just going to be folding. It's cool. No, but it's a no, valid question. It's a valid question.
I think it's bigger than that. I think that like you think about the there's a certain subset of things that you do on your phone that involve your thumb. And for all of those things, that smaller screen is going to make more sense. It's going to be easier to type. It's going to be easier to scroll. It's going to be easier to like move stuff around. It's like that's the tool part of your phone is going to be the closed screen, and then you're going to open it up, and that's going to be the thing you use to watch videos or mess around on Instagram or whatever.
Yeah.
And it becomes like there is a consumption and a creation device, and they're both in one thing now.
It's like
in a way that works
I think it's
way
the
better.
Ultimate commuter device. So
yes.
Like on you have it closed and you're using it during the day like you everything you just said, David, like you're responding quickly to emails, texts, you make phone calls on it because guess what? Even the foldable phone makes phone calls. And then you get on the train to go home or you have a little bit more time to do some work and you open up your screen and you watch Netflix while you also look at email and also do your to-do list. I don't know because it can do three apps at the same time or you just do
so
full
let me
Netflix
just
full
say,
screen.
I think that it's just as valid for people who are, you know, mostly using their phones for like GPS and, you know, they're getting a text on the way home and you shouldn't be looking at it, but maybe you are. And mostly you're trying to stay off your device, but you are using it to navigate. I would love a big old screen that I can just click right into my air vent like I do now with my phone.
I love when I get into an Uber and you see like the Samsung Galaxy tabs running their Google Maps and stuff. It's the most hilarious system. I
this is why Teslas have that big ass screen. It's legitimate. You don't have to squint and possibly get into an accident.
But so really quick before we move on, Joanna, I'm curious, like the S10s to me felt like if your phone is broken, you'll probably buy this one just because it's the new one. But there was nothing to sort of make you like run, not walk to the store and get a new one. Was that your sense too? Is there anything about the sort of everyday phones that blew your mind?
Yeah, I think the fingerprint sensor is really cool, and like I was a little bit jealous of that, you know, being on my iPhone. And facial recognition or Face ID works great for me. I love it. But there are those times where I'm just like, you know, I still would like a fingerprint sensor. I think that to me was like the coolest thing. I'm not sold on all these cameras. I'm looking for you to test them and be like, this is dumb or smart on that we need all these cameras on our phones. But yeah, people were upgrade. I was on CNBC this morning talking about these phones, and one of the hosts asked, you know, do you think this is enough for someone to switch from the iPhone? And I basically just wanted to be like, hell no.
To be fair, nothing is. I mean, there's like,
nobody's switching.
I feel like, I think the number was like 94% of people plan to stick with their same operating system. And it's like, you're not even wondering about other phones. Like, nobody cares. No. So one of the big ongoing questions in the tech industry right now is what role do these companies have in actually policing the content on their platforms? And what about not just the content, but the algorithms that recommend those things to people to read or like or watch or whatever? So the fact that you can click on a video on YouTube that is by itself pretty normal, and then three recommendations later, you're deep in a conspiracy theory rabbit hole, that feels like a problem. But how do you fix that problem? So lots of companies have been asking this question, but this week, Pinterest actually has a solution. It's like a pretty dramatic one. It had been hosting all of this anti-vaccine content, and so Pinterest just shut down all searches for any kind of vaccine stuff on the platform. And it seems to have worked. So Bob McMillan on our team reported on what that has done to Pinterest and discovered a lot about what companies can do and are willing to do to avoid having this controversial or misleading content on their platforms. So I'm going to go get Bob to explain. He's just outside. I'll be right back.
Joanna, can I verify that you have not heard of the 20th anniversary Macintosh, which came out 22 years ago?
I mean, maybe I do, but I didn't know that, like, it was like, that's what that thing...
I've seen this crazy thing.
I just didn't know that's what
it was on the last
called.
Season of Seinfeld.
I didn't know that that's what this was called.
Yeah, and it has the, like, CD drive right in the middle, and it has that beautiful old school, I wish they would bring it back, the rainbow stripe logo, which I just, you know, breaks my heart every time I look at these dull white logos that are soulless.
I don't think I knew that it came with a Bose speaker.
I bet that Bose speaker is still really good, too. Talk about a hipster. Imagine.
So you're saying this is the foldable phone of the past? This
yes.
is
what Bose speakers?
No, the 20th anniversary Mac.
Bob, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. My pleasure,
so,
David.
Tell us, how did you come into this Pinterest story? Like, where, what was the sort of genesis of reporting this?
Well, we had been reporting on misinformation on these platforms. Daniela, my other reporter on this, and I were thinking broadly, okay, what are the other areas where misinformation could be harmful? And everybody's kind of familiar with hoax science on the social media platforms, and we just started digging and digging. There was this video that I saw in December, now that I think about it, that had been viewed by 200 million people. And in the video, it was on Facebook, it explained that if you put a piece of coal in peanut butter, you could get a diamond.
Okay.
Your china, taped it up and soaked it in milk overnight, it would make the china whole. It was all this total nonsense.
What?
And so that was really like that video. When I saw that had been seen 200 million times, I thought, what other, you know, scientific misinformation is out there? And Danielle and I just started looking, and we quickly, you know, people have been talking about the vaccine thing, but we sort of zeroed in on medical health. And it turned out that Pinterest had actually been thinking about this even prior to this amazing video that I saw on Facebook, and had been making some changes that were pretty controversial within sort of the alternative science community, I guess you'd call them.
Yeah. So what was Pinterest's problem? Like as you understand it and as they were working on it, like what was the thing they were trying to solve?
Well, they didn't want to cause harm to the users. And they had been working with Storyful, this organization that helps you understand, you know, the virality of content. And they had identified that there were people on their platform that were very passionately sharing information about wellness, and that some of that information was dangerous. That's what they felt. And so in September, they changed their terms of service. Pinterest, they had long been thinking about self-harm. So if you, you know, do a search for suicide on Pinterest, nothing will show up but except for some advice on how to get help. So they've been thinking about these kind of things even for the year before this. But in September, they said, okay, we're going to look at fake cancer cures, and we're going to look at anti-vaccine information. And if we see it on the platform, we're going to remove it. Now, the problem they had was there was just so much of it that they couldn't remove it all.
Sure.
At that time, they had to start thinking about other ways of addressing it. And, you know, the business – so what we reported in our story was that they just stopped making searches for vaccination, for cancer cure, for breast cancer cure, for a bunch of terms. They just stopped producing results for them. Now, Pinterest says this is just a stopgap. We want to do a better job than just like not giving you any information. But that's what they're doing right now.
Right. So – and that's what – that – gap is what's so interesting to me, because it seems like it makes sense that that is the only thing that anyone can figure out how to do, because, like, to your point, the middle ground is so difficult, where it's like, okay, we know we have this problematic content on our site. We have no idea how to stop people from posting it or figure out what's what. And, like, the line between okay and wrong is not obvious. And I don't know. So I feel like, you know, you've talked about this with YouTube and others too, where it's mm-hmm. like, what is the option other than just sort of pretending it doesn't exist and removing it all from search results and stuff?
Well, so you said an interesting thing there. You said the middle ground is difficult. I think the real word is expensive, right? Mm. So all of these tech companies are facing this question of what they need to moderate and when they should moderate. Long ago, they felt that they were neutral platforms and they didn't have any business stepping in and moderating.
And they
things.
Have a bunch of legal protection that says so, right?
That's
what DMCA
yeah.
was about.
Yeah, that's right. That's okay. right. But their users and the public have decided that that's not acceptable, that they actually need to take a role. And so with jihadist recruitment, you know, the platforms really stepped in and started preventing, you know, YouTube and Facebook from being recruitment tools for jihadists. So that was like the beginning of it. Then the election interference, clearly that everybody felt that what was going on there was unacceptable. So they're stepping in on that. And health is kind of the new frontier. Hmm. So when we were reporting the story, one thing that was really interesting to me was Google has long thought about this with respect to their search platform. So if you do a Google search for vaccination information right now, you'll actually get pretty good results. You get a range of results. And I think that my sense is that Google is not trying to only give you, you know, like trying to completely exclude the anti-vax world from mm-hmm. its results. There, you can get there if you want to. But the preponderance of what you get is scientifically legitimate. And they have these things called cards, which I think you probably know if you use Google. They sort of are these short things that show up at the very top of your search results that kind of quickly explain to you the topic you're looking for.
The ones that like try to actually sort of answer your question.
Yeah, they're sort of like, and then you can kind of burrow into them and click to get a little bit more information. So Google search does a very good job curating this kind of information. YouTube is the Wild West, right? Like there's none of that. Now Google is now saying YouTube is going to start doing these kind of things, but it's expensive to do this, and it takes a human hand to curate this kind of stuff.
You know, I've been thinking about this great story over the last day or so, and it kind of just dawned on me, and I'm just interested to hear, like, in the reporting of this, it seems like Pinterest, because of what Pinterest is, right? And I just Googled Pinterest, and they say, discover recipes, home ideas, style, inspiration, and other ideas to try. Like, because of what Pinterest really wants to be or is, like, can a company like Pinterest take a move like this and it's okay? But like Google or YouTube or Facebook or Twitter, which really is like, you know, information sources at this point, right? A platform where people and other types of sources all congregate. Like, does Pinterest have that ability because of what it is, right?
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, if you think about it, like if Google stopped returning searches for vaccine, you know, that would be a bigger public health problem than Pinterest, you know, actually having all this anti-vax stuff. They can't do that.
Right. Google to a degree, but like you, I'm just sort of trying to spout off like the social layers of the other services, right? Like where this misinformation typically finds more of a life, which is.
Well, and even like tonally, like Pinterest has always been fairly straightforward about like, we are a happy place for happy people to do happy things. And then you go to the other side and it's like Twitter, which has versions of this problem, is like, we are about free speech. And YouTube has always said, like, we host everything. Like, it's, I wonder if, you know, after a decade of saying one thing, it makes it a lot harder to do anything that appears the other way.
Right.
A Twitter, this didn't make it into our story, but Twitter's response, we asked what Twitter was doing to deal with disinformation of this nature on their platform. And their response was, free speech is the answer. I mean, it boiled down to that. Like, the more we allow people to talk about things, the more that this stuff will just get figured out.
So they haven't read all the research about their own platform that shows how these things turn into feedback loops where people's confirmation bias essentially radicalizes them and drives a lot of this?
Mm-hmm. I don't think there's an easy answer for Twitter on this. You know what I mean? Like, they that was their comment.
Did you come across this whole concept? You know, Rene DiResta, who is a researcher on these topics, calls it freedom of speech versus freedom of reach. So you can say whatever you want on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, but it's up to them to decide whether the algorithm will amplify that message.
Yeah, and one aspect of that, I think that's true. I think that's what's happening. But one aspect of that, especially when you look at vaccinations, people that are passionate about vaccinations tend to be passionate about the great, what they perceive to be is the scandal of the global cover-up mm-hmm. of the dangers of vaccinations. Like, I have kids, and they've been vaccinated, and I didn't get really passionate about the fact that they got vaccinated and were prevented from getting measles. So there's this asymmetry between passion that's also feeding into this phenomenon. And that's what Renee talks about. We did interview her for the story, and she felt like she actually got into a lot of her research through studying the anti-vaxxer movement. And she sort of feels that there is just so much passion on the side of the anti-vaxxers. You get this small vocal minority that gets to kind of almost mob the algorithms on some of these platforms, and that contributes to the feedback loops that you're describing.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it does feel like with the YouTube example in particular that there's some anger about the fact that this content exists at all. But the much bigger problem, at least for YouTube, is the fact that if you just press play on not that video, you know, three recommendations later, you're in that video, and that somehow this system has been gamed to give you that stuff even when you weren't asking for it and you didn't go looking for it. Like, if you want to search for anti-vax videos on YouTube, I think you could make a case that stuff is going to exist and they might as well return search results on it. But to just put that in front of your face feels like a different sort of problem.
Well, and another problem, I think, is that YouTube has long been optimized for engagement, for making you watch stuff. And so, again, it comes back to my experience. Like, I am not that interested in watching a video about the, you know, successful long history of vaccination sure. programs in the United States. Like, that is a little dry. I mean, I get it. But if there is some sensationalistic topic around vax, yeah, I mean, some of the stuff that you hear about in these anti-vax videos is really sensationalistic. And that's like, give me the popcorn, you know, I'll sit back and watch that. It's much more entertaining.
Right, which makes more people watch it, which makes YouTube mm-hmm. recommend it more, which makes more people watch, and it's just like
that's a business
flywheel model,
yeah. Right? And I think that's part of why YouTube has had a different approach to this than Google Search. Google Search, you want to get to the information that's accurate as quickly as you can. You don't want to just sit there like mindlessly sort of searching terms all day. It's a little bit of a different of a financial incentive.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the way that people have put it most memorably for me is when you talk about Facebook. We have outsourced our political discourse to a platform that is optimized for making ads go viral. So that medium determines, mm-hmm. in some sense, what the message is.
It's all about the money.
That's sort of a terrifying way to think about social media, that all these platforms are just ways that are engineered for ads to go viral. So in Pinterest's case, you mentioned they think of it as a stopgap. Like, what's your sense of what they'd like to do? Like, what's the better solution here?
Well, I think they want to sort of follow the Google search model a lot more. They want to consult with recognized, you know, experts on the topic, the WHO, CDC, incorporate, you know, what the guidance is there, and then return search results that can deliver stuff that won't mislead their users. They also need to get better at identifying bad content on their platform and not suggesting that to people. And one of their big problems is that it's possible to share content that's hosted on Facebook and YouTube on Pinterest. So what they've done with a lot of the anti-vax stuff is they'll just block domains. If something's coming from a domain that's known to be associated with crank cures or anti-vaccination material, they'll just block it.
But you can't block YouTube.
You can't block YouTube. You can't block Facebook.
Interesting. So
how many times in your reporting did you hear the term AI as a solution?
That's what I was going to ask.
We had to ask them about that. It's part of the what they do. They do their ways of kind of understanding what it, you know, they're sort of in an interesting place because they're visually driven. So there are ways of understanding what the meaning of images is, but it's not as advanced as with text. So it's kind of harder for them.
You'd think Pinterest might be ahead in that space, even though I really have to say, like, I hadn't thought about Pinterest. Like, this is the first time, your article was the first time I thought about Pinterest since my wedding 7 years ago.
Well, thank you. I think.
Five years ago, sorry. Great. My wife's going to listen to this podcast, and I'm going to be in trouble.
You better get that right. So this is the great challenge that I think all of the tech companies are facing. They have built these business models on automated content being generated by their users and just systems like basically milking the money out of it. AI sort of represents an alternative to having tens of thousands of humans go through the content and make judgments about it. So it's kind of an existential leap they have. It's almost like a moonshot they have to make in order to be able to police their platforms. So Facebook really wants to do it. Google wants to do it. They have a lot of money. Pinterest, you know, doesn't. They're just not as big. They don't have the AI research arm that you see at a Facebook or a Google. So they clearly think that that's going to be part of what the solution. But I'm not sure if they really know how they're going to get where they need to be.
Fair enough. Bob, thank you for being here.
My
appreciate
pleasure.
It. He's gotten like 12 phone calls while we've been sitting here. So he's
this is such an exciting time for Pinterest. Who knew? who had any idea?
Okay, coming up in just a second, we're going to talk to Franklin Leonard, the creator of The Blacklist, and the Journal's own Ben Fritz, all about how Hollywood is changing. But before we do, I have an Oscars-related tip for you. So there's like a million stories every year about how to watch the Oscars for free without cable. But I don't know what you guys do, Joanna and Christopher, but my answer is just every year I sign up for some new service for a week or 2 weeks and watch it. And the answer this year, I think, is everybody should just sign up for YouTube TV because it has local channels most places. It's super easy to cancel. It's super easy to sign up, and it works on lots of different devices.
I've done it, and it is easy to sign up for and easy to cancel. Yes.
Yeah. And I feel like too many of them are not easy to cancel, so you wind up accidentally paying for like 3 months just because you don't want to make the phone call to cancel. But YouTube TV is like two clicks to cancel, so if you don't want to use it, just watch the Oscars and get rid of it.
Why not just buy cable?
Because I'm not a billionaire, China.
I'm going to be in a hotel room, so I'm going to be watching. I guess I could get YouTube TV and watch on my laptop, or I could just watch on the hotel TV.
I kind of like that you could just watch. Like that would probably be cheaper for a lot of people than paying for a month of cable. Like go to a hotel,
yeah,
get it for the night, and watch the Oscars there.
Come to my hotel room, everyone. You heard it here on the podcast.
And I should say, even for most people who don't normally watch the Oscars, including me, this seems like a good one to keep tabs on. It's the whole run up to this has been an insane mess, and the Oscars has done everything wrong, and it's going to be a weird hostless awards crazy.
Oh, right, because Kevin Hart is not hosting anymore.
Yeah, and then they never found a host, so there just is no host. It's going to be a very strange Oscars, so in which case it's going to be very fun. And so speaking of which, coming up in just a second, a brief story on how Hollywood is changing and the email newsletter that's helping change it for the better.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Since it's Oscars week, let's talk about the movies. One of the enduring mysteries of show business, which anyone who's ever tried to break into Hollywood can tell you, is how things actually get made. Who picks projects? What do they want? How do they figure out what other people want? Are they right about what people want? What even is a good movie? It turns out the first step, if you have to pick one, is just to find great scripts.
You know, I used to work for Anthony Minghella, and he always used to say, like, you can make a good movie from a good screenplay. You cannot make a good movie from a bad screenplay. So start with a good screenplay.
That's Franklin Leonard. And Anthony Minghella, who he mentioned, was a director and screenwriter who made The English Patient, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and a bunch of other amazing things you've probably heard of. Anyway, Franklin Leonard is a former studio executive who, in 2005, just couldn't find enough good scripts to read. So he emailed dozens of people in Hollywood with the same request. Send me a list of the screenplays you liked most but aren't currently making, the ones that just missed the cut. In exchange, Franklin told them, I'll put everyone's list together and send it to everyone. And thus was born The Blacklist, which became an annual drop of the best under-the-radar screenplays out there.
And it was really a fundamentally selfish endeavor. I was just trying to find some good screenplays to read. I was reading a ton of scripts. Most of them were mediocre to bad, and I didn't want to spend my entire life reading bad scripts. You know, my mom was calling me every week asking me if my LSAT scores were still valid and if I still had, thoughts of going to Yale Law School. And I did, but I didn't really want to go. So the initial thing was selfish. And then as we began to sort of, you know, do the list every year and evaluate this and make the website, I realized just how deeply the access issues ran. Because I would ask senior people in the industry, you know, if I'm a great writer, how do I get my work to someone who can do something with it? And the answer was, well, you can enter the Academy Screenwriting Competition, which, you know, the Nickel Fellowship, which has been around for 30 years and does an excellent job, but it's once a year and there's 7,000 entrants. Or, you know, you just pick up and move to LA and sort of network until someone pays attention to you. And, you know, I'm a black kid from West Central Georgia. I know what the consequences of those access issues are. I was lucky enough to go to Harvard and then end up, you know, through friends of friends in the industry. But, if you're a single mother on the south side of Chicago, or you're a single, you're a suburban dad in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and your kids come home from school and you're like, pack up the minivan, we're moving to LA, you're a terrible parent. And that doesn't mean you're not a good writer. Right. And so, you know, what I wanted to create, given those realities, was if you have the goods, if you are a good writer, you should have the shot at having a career.
To be fair, it's not like nobody liked these scripts before they hit the blacklist. They were there because lots of people liked them. But suddenly there was this validation that these scripts were good because other people liked them. So these movies started getting made and they started winning awards, a lot of awards.
And the Oscar goes to Graham Moore, The Imitation Game.
Slumdog Millionaire, Christian Coulson, producer.
Michael Arndt for Little Miss Sunshine.
Aaron Sorkin, The Social Network.
Diablo Cody for Judah.
King's Speech, Ian Canning, Emil Sherman, and Gareth Unwin, producers.
Argo.
Even this year, Bohemian Rhapsody, which was a blacklist script all the way back in 2007, is nominated for Best Picture and a bunch of other Oscars. Bird Box, which was a huge hit but isn't going to win any Oscars, was on the list a few years ago. On some level, you would think that this means the blacklist has done its job. Great screenplays get made now, even when they're not Marvel movies or starring Vin Diesel. Plus, we're in the middle of peak TV, where lots of companies and studios and tech platforms are suddenly dropping billions on original content. So the internet's a meritocracy, the best stuff wins, hooray, everything's great, right? Franklin told me he doesn't quite see it that way.
There's a series of assumptions about what can work in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. You know, people said Juno couldn't work. People said Slumdog Millionaire couldn't work. People said King's Speech couldn't work. And a lot of that conventional wisdom in the industry is all convention and no wisdom. And that happens in ways that are, you know, amusing, right? Like Juno, okay, I guess we're not going to make this comedy about a girl who's trying to decide whether to have an abortion. But there are really pernicious ways in which that conventional wisdom works. You can't sell black movies abroad. Never seen any statistical justification for that conclusion, but it is accepted as law in the industry. At the end of the day, people want to see good movies and to feel something when they go to the theater or they're watching it at home. The rest kind of doesn't matter. And if you can deliver that, and I think that we can by focusing on identifying great writing, we should make money, we should make a lot of good stuff, and maybe we can change the way people see the world.
Because of the power of the internet to show good things, Franklin and The Blacklist are actually getting into financing and producing movies now. They've seen how much money these otherwise unmade scripts can generate. Franklin said he's done the back of the napkin math and found that it would be a pretty good investment strategy to just make films based on blacklist scripts. The system, Franklin told me, is never going to be perfect. There's no objective measure of a good screenplay or a way to draw a straight line from a great screenplay to a great and profitable film. This whole thing is just too messy and human.
I think that at best, we can try to capture the human a large number of human responses to a piece of material. And that should give us a competitive advantage vis-a-vis any individual who's trying to make the decisions or any computer who's trying to make a decision about what a piece of material is. I do think that, like, look, we can have all the signal in the world from a screenplay that it's amazing, but there are a million decisions that come from between a screenplay and a movie being on your screen that can turn that screenplay into not a good movie.
After Franklin and I finished talking, I kept thinking about that idea that you couldn't build a perfect system for figuring out what works. Because it kind of feels like that's what Hollywood has become. Isn't that why we keep getting sequels and reboots and spin-offs and just endless, endless Marvel movies? Isn't the current movie industry just an example of what happens when studios get a lot of data about what other people like and make all their decisions based on it? That's what I asked Ben Fritz, the Wall Street Journal's LA bureau chief and the author of a book called The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. He had some ideas.
If you think about theatrical movies, that's, I think you're correct. For one individual piece of content is what I would say. So if you are spending a couple of $100 million to make one movie, then yes, the most money you can make is to have a hit film that grosses $1 billion at the box office and then sells millions of DVDs or digital downloads and then gets licensed to a lot of money for a lot of money to HBO or Showtime or Netflix or whatever. That's where the most money is for an individual piece of content, for sure. The reason those are the primary types of films we see is for any other type of film, a movie that's not going to gross $1 billion, the economics of streaming get more and more attractive and the risks of flopping at the box office are getting higher and higher. The paradoxical thing is the higher the risk gets to the box office, the safer it is to make these big movies because people are actually most likely to go to the theater to see the big Fast and Furious Transformers type event film because A, you can't get that on TV still, and B, that's the kind of movie that's really enjoyable on a big screen and in a group with other people around. So that's something Netflix can't replicate. There are very few things Netflix can't do, but the excitement of seeing the latest Marvel sequel or a horror film, which is why horror still works like A Quiet Place, that Netflix can't seem to quite replicate. Everything else they can do, and that's why you don't see theatrically released films really competing as much as they used to, and barely at all, in fact, in all these other genres that they used to, like dramas, thrillers, romantic comedies, etc.
Kind of seems like the potential end result of this is that the theater just becomes a place for superhero movies, basically. And then we end up with something else for, like, it seems significant that Roma, which is a real Best Picture nominee, is primarily a Netflix experience for most people.
Absolutely. Roma has a good chance of winning. And, you know, it's a beautiful film. It's arguably the best film of the year, in all ways the equivalent of any theatrically released film, but it wasn't theatrically released in any meaningful way. And 95% or more people saw it on Netflix. And why is that up for an Oscar? Why don't we consider that a made-for-TV movie? It's very debatable, certainly. The lines are blurring. And for people who want to hold a line and defend theatrical movie going, I think this is a real inflection point. It's a real moment to be concerned.
Okay. So am I crazy in hearing all of that and thinking that for me, as a person who likes movies but mostly doesn't feel the need to go to the theater, that this is universally a good thing? That ultimately it's going to mean there are more places to make these non-superhero movies and I'm going to have more opportunity to see them without blowing my Friday night and $100 to go see a movie?
Yes. Okay. I think, yes, it is almost entirely good news if the theatrical movie going experience is not something that's important to you.
Except for the people who are used to making a whole lot of money from the theatrical movie experience.
It's bad news to them. It's bad news for people who do value the theatrical movie going experience. And there are risks. I mean, I think there are risks. It's more and more as movie production becomes like a way to fuel online video subscriptions as opposed to a business in and of itself. You know, it used to be the studios, their main business was making movies. So they could have a bad year or a few bad years and they would, okay, we got to fix our movie slate. We got to do this better because we're a movie company. We got to keep making movies. But if something goes really wrong, we're in a recession or one of these tech companies that's, you know, like Netflix or Amazon or AT&T, which now owns Warner Brothers, they start hitting some roadblocks. They need to cut spending or they need to rejigger their business. They might say, why are we making all these movies? Maybe it's an opportunity to cut back and focus on our core business. You know, we're Amazon. Why are we making films? We're Apple. Why are we making films? Where maybe Netflix should just focus on TV. Maybe AT&T should really just cut back in this entertainment crap and focus on our, you know, on our cell phones, digital data. And then all of a sudden you could see a lot fewer films. I mean, that's the danger. These companies are not really in the movie business the way that traditionally Universal and Fox and Warner Brothers have been. So to me, that's a concern, because I think movies are a really special thing. And I certainly worry about movies being made by companies that aren't essentially in the movie business.
Okay, so I want to talk about the Oscars. Is the long-term change here going to have to be the Oscars sort of rethinking even the parameters? Like, it doesn't seem that crazy to me that eventually the Oscars is going to have to remove the rule that says a movie has to be in theaters to be considered for an Oscar. Like, is the Oscars going to come towards the future, or is it just going to kind of disappear? Or neither, I guess.
Yeah, I don't agree with that, because if they're going to get rid of the rule that says you have to play in theaters, then they might as well just merge with the Emmys. I mean, what's the point? What's the point of having a different award? You could just have one big award show that's for all the visual content, you know, released on any platform in the last year. And frankly, that award show might be really popular. That might be, it might speak more to the way people today consume their content.
Just give it back to MTV. Make it the reboot the VMAs.
Seriously. I mean, if the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences really cares about theatrical movie going, I think that is a very valid position to take. And I think they need to make a choice. They could do what you said and just said, where about movies, which we define as stories that are told in under 3 hours on any platform that aren't episodic. Mm-hmm. And then that can be that. Or, and I think this is the direction that they would prefer to go, and I think they really need to do it, is say, we're about theatrical movie going. We're going to tighten the rules about playing in theaters. And I think if they were to do that, what they really need to do then is make real efforts to encourage theatrical movie going. You know, they need to advertise about the benefits of seeing films in theaters to get young people out. They need to have, they need to work with the theater chains to offer, you know, let's say student discounts to see all the nominated best pictures, or bring them into schools, or they need to do whatever they can do to attract people, especially young people, into theaters.
That's fair.
Okay, so before I let you go here, is there anything else on your mind for the Oscars? Like, what are you going to be watching most closely for this weekend?
What we haven't talked much about is just the show and what kind of a mess the show is.
It's such a mess.
It's such a mess. They don't have a host. They try to make these changes to shorten the show and put some of the awards, where they would give it out during commercial break and then show an edited version of the acceptance speech live. Everybody got outraged and they pulled back from that. It's sort of, to me, it's like a small microcosm of all the problems Hollywood has. Hollywood is so bad at embracing change and figuring out how to adjust to change. And they've obviously been slow to see what Netflix has been doing to them. And they've been slow to deal with things like windows or make the movie theater experience better, which is why all these streaming services are eating their lunch. And the same thing with the Oscars, like, they clearly need to make the Oscars a better show. You know, it needs to move faster. Frankly, like, all these acceptance speeches in categories that are sort of below the line and most people don't care about, like sound effects editing, they need to find ways to shorten them, or, you know, which I think showing them during the commercial break, giving them during the commercial break and cutting down the speeches in edited form was a pretty reasonable idea. And you could say the same thing like for the short films that nobody has seen. Like, why are we giving these out in primetime television? It makes for very boring TV. And the fact that the Oscars cannot find a way to change the show and make it more entertaining because people in Hollywood complain and they easily give in, kind of like a bad parent whose kid starts whining, is a very bad sign for the film business in general's ability to handle change.
Yeah, that's fair. And they never found a host, right? Is it going to be you? You could just host.
It might as well be. You know, I mean, that's how tough it is.
And that's our show, everybody. Thanks to Franklin, Ben, Bob, Christopher, and Joanna for being here. Thanks to Tanya Bustos, our producer. And thank you for listening. We have new episodes, as always, on Fridays. So make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. If you're looking for one, there's this cool app called Breaker I've been trying. It's really social and a neat way to find new stuff to listen to. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.